Okay. Welcome to episode 46 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. Have an awesome episode today. Brian, I know you've been talking about it all morning and all weekend, the successful Starship launch caught with the chopsticks. How is this going to impact real estate, Brian? Let's hear.
Well, it's, you know, I think it's a work in progress. I think first it's the, you know, it's the kid in me that's been watching videos all weekend and just fully amazed, right? It's a 400 foot tall rocket, the largest object ever lifted off of the largest and heaviest object ever lifted off of the Earth's surface. And it goes, pushes, Starship into orbit. And you've got this 200, it's a, basically a 22 story building plummeting at half the speed of sound towards the Earth. And then it lights up those thrusters. It uses just an engineering that's just amazing. The thing weighs 200 tons, right? It weighs as much basically as a fully loaded, Dreamliner that's doing a East Coast to West Coast trip full of people, full of fuel, weighs the same thing as that massive Boeing jet. And they catch it in this, you know, in those chopsticks. It's just an amazing, amazing engineering feat, and one that I think I watched about 100 times. And then I started to talk to some other people in kind of my circle, like, how does this impact real estate? And actually, my brother said to me, he goes, you got to be, and this is how you translate it to real estate. And Tucker, I know you know this data better than anyone per our conversation, but, and I'll let you throw the stats on why. But as this, you know, this vehicle gets more to space cheaper and faster, and it's going to open a whole new market for companies. My brother was telling me about, now think about this, so cool, company called Reflect Orbital, right? This startup that when they can launch their technology, their satellites into space, which are effectively large mirrors, you can go on an app, and I could be oversimplifying this, but I believe this is the case. You can go on an app, and if you want to have sunlight past sunset, you could request it, pay for it, and there, their technology, the satellites will redirect sunlight to your home. So you can stay in the sun longer for whatever event you're having, right? So it's just like one example of this whole new world we're going to, never mind going to Mars and all of the intergalaxy stuff that he's talking about. Like here on Earth, our life is going to change potentially very quickly because of this SpaceX rocket that we're launching, and this weekend was testament to that.
A lot of people forget that SpaceX has now been around for around 2 decades, right? So it's the, you know, it takes 20 years to be an overnight success. Obviously, SpaceX has been having a lot of success for a while now, but you think back to like overnight success being, maybe landing the first rocket or, the first successful launch or the first rocket being reusable. But, you know, really this inflection point of Starship is probably the most important engineering achievement of our lifetimes. I mean, it's of course, I think there will be things that eclipse this as, the rate of hardware advancement just advances across clean energy sectors and, space exploration and things like that. But I mean, this is truly the most impressive feat of engineering that I think has ever been accomplished by humans. I mean, it's like that order of magnitude. But yeah, when you think about the actual business side of things of what does Starship actually mean in the short term, medium, and long term, obviously this unlocks the missions to Mars that Elon has said he plans to launch every 22 months when Mars is in the window where you can actually launch most efficiently to reach Mars. But from purely a opening of market standpoint, the impact on this is basically a 15x reduction in the cost per kilogram to get to space. Right now, and I guess I should preface this by saying that the cost per kilogram for SpaceX to get something to orbit does not necessarily correlate with the cost it charges its customers. In the case of SpaceX, they effectively have a monopoly on affordable launch. just because all of the other rockets are so far behind in terms of cost of manufacture, reusability, and all that. So right now, if you were looking at 2026 launch windows for SpaceX, you're looking at between $4,000 and $8,000 per kilogram to get to orbit. And that's based off of like Falcon 9 and Super Heavy and the launch vehicles that SpaceX is using today for commercial launches. And keep in mind, a lot of the product that SpaceX is launching are its own satellites for Starlink. It's important to note that cost of $4,000 to $8,000 per kilo to launch is so crazy low compared to what people thought it would ever be. And the initial skepticism around SpaceX beyond like, hey, obviously it's very challenging to do these engineering feats that they're talking about doing was, what do you really need to get in orbit? If the cost to get into orbit is so expensive, you don't really have business models that make sense. But just like this, satellite mirror technology to create 24-hour sunlight for someone, which by the way, that's like the ultimate troll. Like you don't like your neighbor, you just light up their house 24/7. Like somebody's totally going to abuse this. But if Starship brings down the cost by 15x, it only further unlocks a ton of business models that no one has even contemplated yet. No one anticipated that one of SpaceX's primary drivers of revenue would be essentially global internet access. No one anticipated that, even SpaceX, when they started the company. And because the cost to launch has gotten so much lower, that unlocks Starlink. And now we're going to see another 10 to 15x reduction, depending on whether you're comparing Falcon 9 or like Falcon 9 Super Heavy to Starship, to get something into orbit. And people are not even anticipating what new companies are going to come out of this, but there's going to be really significant opportunities to come out of this 100%.
Yeah, I think, Tucker, some of the things we were talking about that gets really interesting for, especially for New England here, is some of the drug discovery, at zero gravity. Now they have to use these massive chambers or machines to create zero gravity, right? And they artificially create it inside a machine. When you can go and start doing testing and see what the reaction of different drugs or different procedures or whatever it is that the science community is really excited to do, it unlocks the opportunity for new uses of existing drugs and how they interact with each other, new technology to manipulate existing drugs or to create brand new ones. And that's, from the benefit of mankind, I think that's going to be something we probably see pretty quickly in our lifetime based on some of the things you and I were talking about, Tucker.
Yeah. The other impact of Starship is I think there's so many young engineers that are contemplating whether they do something in the software space or they figure out how to optimize advertising spend nominally, as a software engineer or something, and they're making decisions around their future. And I think when you see things that SpaceX and other hardware technology companies are doing to either, advance space exploration, advance humanity, to protect the United States or whatever their, respective missions are, I think that it really is inspiring the next generation of engineers and that we're going to see more of a push into next generation hardware companies being developed. I mean, over the last 20 years, if you look at the amount of people that have, are SpaceX alumni that have started companies or are early employees that are key to advancing new companies that, maybe they're not a founder, but they're a critical person there. I mean, it's mind-boggling. There's probably no company in the history of the world that has had more of an impact on hardware engineering as a whole, even beyond just, rocket launch and space exploration capabilities than SpaceX. And this only, furthers it. So I think there's a lot of people that that are maybe negative on Elon Musk at various points because he's intense and, sometimes has controversial takes. But how can you not love Elon Musk? Like with everything this guy is doing to, build electric vehicles, to build solar panels, to, implant chips in people's brains to restore limb control to people that have disabilities, to everything that's happening in the space exploration, you know, digging next generation tunnels with the Boring Company. I mean, like, it's truly just unbelievable what this guy is doing. And because he has hot takes on Twitter occasionally, it seems like, 30 or 40% of the country doesn't like him. And to those people, I just really scratch my head. Like, how can you not like this guy? I mean, this is, I think the greatest entrepreneur the world has ever seen. So, and his impact on Los Angeles is just insane in terms of, it's really hard to find a hardware technology company that hasn't been majorly influenced either by talent, management style, kind of pace of really rapid iteration and shipping off of SpaceX. So anyways, hopefully this is a wake up call to any haters out there that you don't have to agree with everything he does, but you do have to, give respect where respect is due. And it's certainly due here.
Yeah, to totally separate the that portion of it, just look at it from a pure business perspective and a humanity and mankind perspective. As I was looking at SpaceX and Starship this weekend, I pivoted to try to continue to look at real estate, and I started down a path to look at XAI, his AI startup that he founded in July of 23. I think on the heels of OpenAI and his kind of public breakup with that company as being the original or one of the original investors in it. And now he's effectively sold all his shares, to others. But the, XAI announced, I think in September of 23, that they were going to open a new gigafactory in Memphis. It came to be that the site of this gigafactory was a former Electrolux. If everyone who listens to the pod knows Electrolux, the old school vacuum company. I think they make microwaves and some other kitchen appliances as well. But I certainly know them growing up from their vacuums. They had a factory they opened around 12 years ago in, I believe, South Memphis. They exited that, and I think they moved to another one in the area, actually. But they exited this facility. It was targeted by XAI, a regional developer by the name of Phoenix Investors bought the facility. It's 785,000 square feet. Bought it in December of 23. They started work on the facility in early 2024. This comes from a conversation with NVIDIA's founder, Jensen Huang, around how long it took in partnership between NVIDIA and XAI to do the build out of the data center. And they said they had it from start to operational. And it's not the whole data center, but it's a portion of it in 19 days, which is just, and what he said in that interview was that it's typically 3 years of planning, a year of construction of the data center, and they accelerated the majority of that process into 19 days. And it's a testament of the NVIDIA technology that comes fully assembled in their stack, but also of just another monumental accomplishment by one of Elon Musk's companies. A piece of that is, they need 150 megawatts of power, right? So there's a process you have to go through with the local municipal electric company to align here, right? In the first phase of its 50 megawatts, they brought a new substation online very quickly, and that is the first phase powering this giga center. The second phase, which is 150 megawatts, XAI is actually building it, and they're going to come up with an agreement that provides credits back to them when they turn the substation over to the municipal electric company. So it's just, to me, it's just amazing how someone, but also just American engineers, American ingenuity, American companies can move so quickly if you need to, and you couple that with stories of projects that could be decades to build in other sectors, in other industries, in other companies. You have to sit back and be amazed. And it's going to be the largest supercomputer in the world when it's fully operational?
Yeah, there's so many questions I would like to ask to the team at XAI that handled this data center. I mean, just to put in perspective, basically everything in the Memphis area and throughout that area of Tennessee, Alabama, all the way up through Ohio is covered by a regional power company called Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA. And that's the regional power provider that essentially is running the high voltage lines, all throughout these states, and then ultimately ends up delivering to a local utility company that runs the lines to the substation, generally builds the substations. Most of these substations are utility company owned, which it sounds like XAI's first one will be utility company owned, and the second one will be XAI owned until they essentially like sell it back to the utility company. And if you were to ask TVA right now, hey, how long will it take us to build a substation on a property? They will tell you that it's going to be 3 to 4 years to build a substation on your property. And the thing that is gating this right now is access to high voltage breakers. And as a result, if you ask any utility company anywhere, whether it's TVA or someone else, everyone's going to quote you around the same, like no one's going to quote you less than 30 months. So it's sort of like bewildering to me that they were able to build a substation that quickly. I wonder if it's true. I wonder if there was an existing substation with excess power that they're able to use, or if there's existing, high voltage lines of the property and existing substation. Otherwise, it like genuinely doesn't math unless you're able to get a, quasi government level, monopoly, utility provider to do something in, 18 days when it generally takes them, a period that's measured in years. So I'm really curious what the actual story is and how they did this, if that's true.
Yeah, the power, so the first 50 megawatts was an existing substation that they turned back on, and it was part of the reason they went to this area, right? Because there was capacity in a substation that had been decommissioned. The second 150 megawatt substation, they say it's going to be operational in 25. So your question is still a good one, because it's still only 18 months later, right? And having done, fabs for semiconductor companies, you can call in favors, you can find it, you can cut the line in terms of construction for it. If you have, like, I know one, there's kind of side agreements because you have a product that a company wants. Like if they have, if they build a product that the TVA wants, I don't know if it's chips. I don't know what it is. It could be NVIDIA chips for the, for their infrastructure. Who knows? And you can sell those chips to them in priority. They'll give you, they'll give you priority, right? So there's bartering agreements that happen behind the scenes that allow you to cut the line. And I've had clients that have been successful in doing that because they have something that the suppliers want as well, and they're short in supply, and they want, preference as well. So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes to be able to make these projects. So you can't do it at scale beyond, individual projects. You have to treat each one individually. But just think, if you, any of our listeners have walked into a data center, and think about all of the cabling, just the cabling to be able to have that. And then you have the integration of hardware, software, different pieces from different companies coming together, and just to be able to turn it on, right? Take all the questions of the power, just to be able to turn the thing on in 19 days and have it power up, right? It's just amazing, the engineers. I don't know where he finds his talent, but you certainly, one person can't do this. It's thousands and thousands of people across many companies. And there's a formula there to produce, to find and produce and grow some of the best engineering talent I think the world's ever seen.
For listeners who haven't been in a data center, a typical data center between the power cabling, fiber optics, and then, copper cabling, such as like your Cat 6 for just short runs. A typical data center can have between 50 and 500 miles of total cabling. That's everything from your data cabling to your electrical cabling, et cetera. Think about that for a second. 50 to 500 miles of cable built out in 19 days is just astonishing. Hats off.
I think the reason that the talent is so good is no one that is soft or doesn't want to work incredibly hard goes to work for an Elon company. And as a result, you just have this hyper intense culture that feeds upon itself. And these people are, you know, willing to do whatever it takes to advance humanity. So there's this kind of double bottom line. Brian, going back to what you were talking about, how, you know, there's these side agreements and things like that with the utility companies. That obviously happens, but I think one of the notable things about a transaction like this is that XAI didn't go about getting any economic incentives. And maybe they did go for like statutory incentives. That's more just a process of, you know, documentation. Maybe not, but, and we've talked about this on prior episodes before. It's much more challenging to get, like side deals and special access and things like that for data centers because they generally don't employ very many people, yet they're an enormous, drag on, power. I mean, 150 megawatts in the context of, you know, Memphis or even all of Tennessee. I mean, like, I don't know what this figure is, but I do know what the figure is for a number of other states. Like, the entire, like, statewide power generation capabilities for all of Tennessee, like, it wouldn't surprise me if it's below 10 gigawatts. So 150 megawatts is, like, actually a real amount of power. Like, that's a very serious amount of power in the context of what you might expect for Tennessee's statewide power generation to be. And if you can use that power generation to, you know, 150 megawatts would be enough to have probably a 5 to 10,000 person manufacturing facility making widgets, right? Depending on exactly on what you're making and all that. Or you can have a, you know, data center that is 700 something thousand square feet that might only employ 350 or 500 people. Right. So it's like, what do? You get a, you know, 10, 20x return on the amount of power by doing manufacturing, which is why you see a lot of these data centers located only in states where there is excess power generation, you know, at the state or regional level that these companies can tap into.
Yeah. I think the stat I saw, great point, Tucker. The stat I saw was 100,000 homes, you know, average homes, right?
I think it's more like 150.
Is it that high?
Yeah, because I've always known 100 megawatts will power about 83,000 homes. So it's probably a little bit more, maybe 125, but it's a lot of houses. Think about that for a second. Like, let's say it's 125,000 homes powered by 150 megawatts. It gives you an idea of the unbelievable amount of power being delivered to this facility.
Yeah, but in Tucker, without economic incentives, think about the tax base. Granted, it doesn't bring, there's two mandates typically with these incentives, right? It's taxable investment and it's jobs. Granted, it doesn't bring the huge number of jobs, but you're talking 100,000 NVIDIA H100s. That's billions of dollars just in, you know, just in investments in their chips, and never mind all the other infrastructure that you're bringing. So you're putting a massive taxable base in, you know, in Memphis, and having done a lot of work, I did a built-to-suit down there just a couple of years ago, 250,000 feet. We went and got somewhere around $20, $25 million worth of economic incentives, primarily through property tax abatements. And it's an area that needs revenue and it needs investment. And the downstream results of this hopefully are a benefit to the community, as long as it doesn't negatively impact the TVA's ability to provide services to other businesses that may come along as a result, right? And they've come out and said this is an easy, not easy, but it's a requirement that they can easily solve. They're not at all concerned about it based upon all the literature I was reading. We could just keep going on talking about Elon Musk and all the, you know, this past weekend was also his unveiling of his new, biped robots. They had the Tesla had their big event. So There's just a lot, and he's done so much recently that it's great to talk about it. The impact on the real estate side is, I think, a lot TBD, right? How does these, either of these companies with their recent advancements really, really impact the real estate markets? I think high level, there's been so much clean technology, so much investment in new technology across the country. We're seeing it here. We're seeing it in the battery belt. I mean, everything from nuclear technology that can fit in a suitcase or it looks like a small generator to drug discovery to new, to new ag tech companies. It's just amazing where the U.S. economy has shifted, and continued to evolve with people like Elon, but all of the other thousands of inventors and engineers that are coming up with new ideas every day.
And Brian, just you mentioned the investment on NVIDIA chips. To those who may be frustrated that it didn't create a ton of like actual jobs at the data center itself, but remember that not every job that goes along with data centers is necessarily highly visible. I mean, I think about that. Think of the ecosystem that surrounds a data center between vendors, suppliers, contractors. So I think the economic ripple effects are rather significant. Whereas, you know, your maybe direct, jobs at the center itself might be low. So something just people to keep in mind for those that might not care for Elon's hot takes and therefore not like Elon. I think he's doing more good than bad. And then furthermore, like just think of the regional, competitiveness for the environment. When you open facilities like this, there's a ripple effect for other technology companies to maybe, go, gosh, what interesting that he did it there. Maybe we should be looking there as well. So there's long-term effects as well.
Yeah. Look at it this way. What would you rather have? An 800,000 foot Amazon warehouse with $20 to $25 per hour wages, or an 800,000 foot data center with, 50, 75, whatever these engineers are getting paid to maintain and run a data center, right? It's for the product that it is, that it absorbed. It is a really, really cool investment. It's going to create kids are going to, go to school and learn about it. They're going to be, because if you read XAI's website, they are, and this is, and I believe this comes right from the top, they start to invest in the school systems. They have tours of it. They really want to build the next generation of engineers and look to the stars across his businesses. So yeah, I think if you compare what else could go there, I don't see if Electrolux couldn't make their product there. I'm not sure we're going to see another factory open up that employs thousands of jobs in that building. So then the alternative is you knock it down and put something else there, or it probably becomes a warehouse. So this is, in my mind, it's a pretty good solution for a vacant building sitting there without any taxable revenue.
So Brian, I think it's a little bit more complicated than, is it better to have a data center or is it better to have an Amazon logistics warehouse? I think it really depends on what is the power generation capabilities of the area and the state and the region. Right. If you're in one of the many regions around the country that is completely constrained around power, logistics requires extremely low power. I mean, you'd be dealing with in the, 3, 4, 5,000 amps of power or something for like a typical logistics facility in that size. Whereas instead, you're dealing with 150 megawatts or 200 megawatts of power for this data center. If you're in one of the areas of the country that is power constrained, I would actually argue that you're way better off having the logistics warehouse and saving that power generation capacity for really high touch manufacturing jobs, like high quality manufacturing jobs somewhere else that is more power efficient per job. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Owen making the point around whenever there's an investment of this size, there's a direct job hire, but then there's also indirect jobs, be it from construction or vendors that end up servicing that equipment, things like that. And it's true that the economic impact is always more than just the jobs for that particular facility. But when you start looking at the indirect job multiplier that's typical for data centers versus what's typical for like an aerospace company, like imagine that this was a rocket manufacturing facility instead. Generally, the multiple of or ratio of indirect jobs to direct jobs is 4 to 1. So if you have, 5,000 people that you're hiring in a, SpaceX facility or something, generally that's creating an additional 20,000 job indirect jobs as a result of those jobs. So if you start looking at indirect jobs, I would bet that it makes it look even less attractive for it to be a data center, because even though there is a multiple, the multiple is usually much smaller. So instead of being like, hey, this amount of power could generate 5,000 jobs, or it could generate 500 jobs, depending on whether you're manufacturer or data center, it's really more like this can generate 20,000 or 25,000 direct and indirect jobs, or might generate 2,000 or something. So the spread becomes even wider. And all this stuff is so interesting when you really get deep into how states make decisions around economic development, incentive packages, and how to attract and retain the right types of companies for their respective local economies. But shifting gears, I want to go back to something that Brian said. Obviously, we very recently saw Tesla's investor day, where they, as Brian was talking about, unveiled advancements in Optimus and, Robotaxi and Robovan and all of these very cool products. And when you actually think about the impact on the corporate real estate market of these technologies, it is massively, massively deflationary. If you think of the cost to construct an office building, or you even think of the land requirements to construct an industrial building, if you no longer have to deal with parking because it is cheaper for people to not own a car and be able to have incredibly inexpensive, ubiquitous transportation that can pick you up anywhere in less than a minute at a fraction of the cost that it would cost to actually own a car, that's going to probably reduce the cost of construction of office space in most parts of the country by between 20 and 40, sometimes even percent, sometimes even more. And then when you think about industrial real estate right now in Southern California, generally, if you're building a 500,000 square foot industrial building, it means you need 1 million square feet of land. And that's generally to have enough parking for truck parking, which of course we'll still need. But then also the vast majority of it is for employee parking. And if you go into less expensive markets, like throughout the South or the Rust Belt, it's much more common, instead of having a 1 million square feet to construct 500,000 square feet, you would probably have like 1.5 million square feet. And the reason for that is not necessarily that the parking density is greater or anything like that. The reason is land just really inexpensive. So people have erred on the side of saying, hey, land's not as expensive. Let's just have more land in case a group that comes along that needs more parking. You basically never see that in Southern California. And if that happened, it would mean every industrial building would now require probably in the order of magnitude of 15 to 20, maybe even 30% land to construct what they need. And in supply constrained markets where land is really expensive, like in Southern California, the cost to build new construction industrial buildings in like core Los Angeles or core Orange County, the land is just as expensive as the building construction itself is. So this is going to have a massive impact on either developers getting excess returns as they choose to not build parking, or potentially, hopefully, that cost savings being passed on to tenants. So this is really good news. This is on the order of magnitude of just how, really efficient next generation nuclear reactors is deflationary for the cost of energy. This is deflationary for basically all types of real estate, even extending into, and especially extending into multifamily, where the cost per parking stall is even higher than it is in office and industrial.
Yeah, I think there's another side too. I agree with you 100%. It's also the quality of urban living, right? So I saw a rendering over the weekend or last week about what a city would look like that didn't have massive amounts of parking, right? And it would just explode with green space, explode with walking and biking, because with an automated world of cars, the cars don't need to park at your house. They don't need to park at your work. They just show up and pick you up and take you where you need to go. And then they park outside of the urban core or outside of the city, or they're used for other purposes while, you're working at your job. They're producing revenue for you if you own it, or they're at least, going back to some place to charge that's not a high value real estate location, and then making sure they're back to you when you need it. So just think about how much land that frees up and how much better our cities and towns and communities would be if you didn't have all of this land being used for parking. And Tucker, I will go back to your point on power, because I think this is, you know, this is a fundamental time in history where we've typically looked at construction and we've looked at development based on the constraints of the power grid or power infrastructure. And I think we've got to the point where we're realizing that our distribution infrastructure is so old and so antiquated that to be able to move with the pace of technology, we're not going to be able to upgrade our distribution around the country as quickly as we would need to keep pace. That's when companies, and living here in New England and being around companies that are creating either on-site or new means to generate power quickly, effectively, and in a scalable way. I'll give you one example. There's a company here in New England called Electric Hydrogen. They make 100 megawatt power generation sites you could put at a factory or a data center, right? And you could stack that. So you buy 100 day one, you buy another 100, and then you go in line. So you got 200, you go 3, 4, 5, whatever you want. And the cost of doing that is becoming competitive to be able to buy it from the grid. So there's, I think the constraints of power are, yeah, they're real right now. And we have to deal with these, I would say, you know, archaic power companies around the country. In many places, they're regulated and they're just very slow and difficult to maneuver. I think that the open market and some of these either green tech and green power generation companies or nuclear power companies, and there's a number of those in development very quickly too, that will really change how we think about these projects and how we think about what power is being used and generated. So I'm optimistic that we don't have to continue to look at the constraints we have in the past around these large major projects and look at, you know, one versus another where we could do all.
I love the picture of the future you guys are painting. Like, Brian's talking about a world of abundant, clean power. Tucker's talking about we don't need cars anymore. This is, let's go.
Right? Isn't that what, honestly, that's what I was thinking about all weekend after I saw literally a 22-story building get caught by these big 100-foot arms. You know, and the thing came down at like an angle. It's going so fast, and all of a sudden it's like, boom, stops. It's truly amazing. And, you know, you could put it on a fraction that you probably can't even fit on a page how smart I am compared to the people that did that. But I certainly can be appreciative and look at and watch it and be amazed like I was as a kid looking up at the stars.
Well, how about I bring the conversation back to today and to real estate and to vacant buildings, a theme we seem to hit on a lot. But I spent my Sunday going down a very deep rabbit hole. I'll start the story here. I've got a current requirement in South San Francisco for 100,000 square feet of lab space. And in South San Francisco, there are currently 16 high quality options for 100,000 square feet or greater. Just crazy. And it just so happens that one of them is a development by IQHQ. And it took me down this rabbit hole to remember about IQHQ's San Diego project, the RAD development, and I'm familiar with, you know, they were basically created in 2019, 2020. They raised $2.6 billion, and they're going to go develop world-class life science facilities. And of course, sometime shortly thereafter, the life science market changed. Many people, like Alexandria, ARE, started pulling back their bets, and you know, no new development unless they could sell some asset to free up the capital to fund it. But then some folks just charged ahead where they could get the lending, the loans to proceed. IQHQ is one of those that proceeded full speed ahead in development. But this idea of like, okay, so I haven't heard of any life science leases being signed by IQHQ. They did just do a big press release announce in San Diego about these retail leases they've signed, you know, Equinox. You know, that I'm assuming those have some contingency that if they never fill up the building with life science companies, then who's going to be going to Equinox? Just the people who live downtown? Maybe. Anyway, so no life science leases, and it led me down. So pardon me, I'm going to go into some detail, and you're going to see me in glasses because I printed it so darn small. I basically wanted to look at what have they really what do they own? What have they built? When is it due to complete? What did they borrow and who was the lender? So let me just run down this list. In the Bay Area, I mentioned 580 Dubuque is 340,000 feet. Also, Elko Yards is a project of theirs, 592,000 square feet. Okay, so that's just under 1 million square feet in the Bay Area, under construction, soon to deliver. No leases signed. In Boston, Brian, Fenway Center is their big one, and it's slated for 1 million square feet to complete in 2025. They also have a project, Alewife Park, another 755,000 square feet due to deliver October 2024, right now. And they have a project to 109 Brookline, another 310,000 square feet due to deliver June 2025. Okay, so there's another 2 million square feet in Boston. San Diego, just to round it out, RAD, the one I mentioned, is 1.7 million, effectively complete today. Funded by Bank of the Ozarks. That's my second rabbit hole. I'll go down next with a $915 million loan commitment. They also bought the Aventine office complex and the adjoining hotel. That's another 500,000 square feet that they bought for $432 million. Okay, so if you add all that up, they own or are developing 5.2 million square feet and no leases signed. What in the world? How does that work? And how long does that work? And most of the loans are coming due 2025, 2026, I believe. Okay, and so, well, I'll let you respond. I mean, we've talked about that so much, but how does that work? Who are their original capital partners? And how patient are they? Like, is this a story, the next story to be told that hasn't been written yet? Or do they somehow pull a rabbit out of their hat and get a...
That Fenway project is, as far as I'm aware, there's no leasing at the new building. They've done, I think, 60,000 feet with the company called Strand, who's since sublet out, I think, one or two pieces of that at 109 Brookline. The project in Alewife is 100% vacant. I think they're under construction with a portion of it, not the entire project there. So, but you've got a, you know, there's a ton of upfront fixed costs when you're doing a big project like that, that are sunk into the first building. And it's, I think they're going to be the poster child for the crash in life sciences. It's, it's unfortunate because they're building a good product. The Fenway location is it is adjacent to the Longwood Medical area. So there's a ton of meds and eds in Fenway, and Fenway has become a real mature market in life sciences. It's just a result. I mean, if you were to do that same survey here, John, because this is obviously a much larger life science market, I wouldn't be surprised, and this is kind of greater Boston inside of 128. I wouldn't be surprised if you had 40 plus options for 100,000 feet, right? So it is a large market. It is a very challenged market. And, you know, with IQHQ delivering shell lab space, when you could have, the capital already invested by another company sitting vacant, there's going to be a very challenged time. It could be 5 years before, that the lab market is back to some sort of a normalized place. It's just, there's no demand right now.
It took me down this other rabbit hole about Bank of the Ozarks. And I want to tell this story because San Diego, several other folks also proceeded with construction of new lab buildings into a market where the demand had fallen to virtually zero. I told you about the RAD project and the Aventine project. Also, Sterling Bay and Harrison Street proceeded with construction of a project called Pacific Center. It's 500,000 square feet, due for completion December of this year. That was a $265 million loan at $530 a foot from Bank of the Ozarks. Longfellow went forward with a construction project called BioTerra for 310,000 square feet in Sorrento Mesa. It's now complete. That was funded with a $203 million loan from Bank of the Ozarks. Okay, so no leases signed on any of those three projects. If you add up the loan amounts, that's $1.3 million that I could see Bank of the Ozarks taking back. Can they afford that? Can they handle that? I don't know. But I wanted to tell this story. So, like, why did Bank of the Ozarks go forward? So, it turns out back in, so there was a project, Invesco and Bank of the Ozarks. They did a JV this time. It wasn't just Bank of the Ozarks. Invesco was their partner on this loan. They did a loan for a project called Aperture. And it was originally commenced construction in 2020. And in February of 2022, they secured a 13.5-year lease for the full thing, 535,000 square feet, with Neurocrine Biosciences. I mean, it was a drop-dead, crazy lease. Think of it what you will. Jones Lang LaSalle represented both the landlord and the tenant on that transaction. Development by a company called Gemdale. It's a Chinese, Hong Kong-traded real estate development company. But a total home run. They just crushed it. So here, Bank of the Ozarks delivers on this kind of spec lab construction with a lease signed in February 2022. So that isn't then interesting to notice that they did the deal for RAD in 2020, the Aventine 2022, and then the follow-on investments for Pacific Center in May of 2023 and Bioterra August of 2022. So my theory of the case is they saw the success of this Aperture and thought, this is what we're going to do. Let's proceed on all these others. And I just don't think you're going to catch lightning
twice. So let's take a step back, John. The interesting part about the life science industry is that you can't do build-to-suits for the most, unless you're a big pharma, you can't do build-to-suits, right? Because the time between you're going in your clinical testing, when you need space, to when you need to be doing clinical work in the space is roughly under a year, 9 months is when they decide they need the space and when they need to be operational. So the industry has always been one, if you build it, they will come, right? If you take, take that old saying, fail the dreams, because you can't have a development site ready to go, permitted, and attract a life science company because the construction schedule's too long. So you have to go spec on these developments. And unfortunately, so the strategy, I think, is good. I think two things are wrong. One is location. They secure locations like the San Diego site and some of the stuff in West Cambridge in New England here in Massachusetts are just poor located properties. So those are going to, and there's some, I believe, on the peninsula outside of San Francisco that are even further south than South San Francisco that IQHQ controls that are going to be challenged, right? So they went after and found what they could get their hands on. So locationally, I'm not sure that product will lease first. Secondly, the market. Yeah, and no one really expected it to dry up as much as it has. So demand has fallen off a cliff, and their product is potentially in a location that may not be that desirable, at least portions of their product. So I think both of those factors will really challenge them to be able to stabilize their investments. And what was interesting, and this could have changed and may have changed, but I don't think so based upon what I've been monitoring. Bank of the Ozarks has not written down that $1 billion loan for the investment in San Diego yet, right? So they're still hanging on trying to, and this is the game that a lot of banks are playing right now, is they're continuing to renegotiate or push out maturity dates of loans to be able to try to hang on and see what happens. So we'll, over the next few months here in quarters, I think there'll be a lot more data that comes out, but I don't see the market turning any time or material at any time soon with respect to demand. Maybe the reductions in interest rates might help, but if you don't have underlying demand, I think the problem continues to grow and snowball, and we'll find out what happens. But I think they and others are really trying to figure out another strategy. I mean, I've got a couple requirements right now that life science buildings being converted back to office are really top of the list in terms of where a client wants to focus if they focus on doing these projects. So there's there's a scenario where they kind of write off this base building infrastructure that they've put in, and a lot of the times they haven't put all of it in, but in many cases they put a lot in that would have to be written off, and they would do a competitive office deal on the market with these vacant buildings.
Well, I'll give you two more data points. The interesting you talk about. Well, so I think we mentioned this on the pod before, and you mentioned write downs. So Aimco Funds made an equity investment in IQHU, in that RAD development project. And in August of this year, they took a impairment on their $50 million investment. They took a $47 million impairment. I mean, IQHU is a private REIT, so they don't have to report publicly, but man, the Aimco had to report publicly, and that's what they reported. So what does that tell you? And I'll give you one more data point on the San Francisco surge I was describing with all that vacancy and softness. The softness in the market is not necessarily driving lower asking rental rates, but what is on the table out of the chutes are improvement allowances of up to $350 a square foot, especially from the REITs who, can do more with TI because they're more focused on funds from operations. But, out of the gate offering of $350 a square foot, that's indicative of a soft market. And I'll say one more thing about the San Diego project. You've got Fenway Center. That's in an established life science market. But man, the bet that they made downtown San Diego, where life science had not previously gone, they got a 1.7 million square feet of world-class real estate and an unproven premise as to whether a life science company wants to be there. You can't pivot to office. Office rents are going to be $2, $3, $4 a square foot. You just can't do it. Without a cycle of foreclosure and reset.
It's really interesting to think about why all of this is happening and trying to trace it back to the most original source. And you start thinking about how badly the Federal Reserve gave guidance to all of the banking institutions around what they anticipated interest rates to be. And then you start thinking about all of these life sciences developers that just assumed that the spigot of money for early stage life science companies was going to be infinite. And most of that premise was off of, hey, interest rates are going to remain low for the foreseeable future. We have time to construct this building, deliver the building, and lease it before there's any risk of interest rates increasing. So you start thinking about who was the most reckless here, right? Like who is responsible for these bad decisions? And ultimately, it's like all these life science REITs are responsible. IQHQ, ultimately they're responsible, right? They need to be looking around the corner, making predictions around what they're going, what they think is going to happen. But just the scale at which a lot of these life science developers were wrong is kind of unprecedented, right? Like the amount of overbuilding that has happened into massive sublease supply and very limited demand is unusual. Like this doesn't happen, every year or even every cycle with the amount of space that's available. So if you just start backing up further and further and further and thinking, how did they let this happen? I think most of it comes down to not understanding the venture capital space as well as they should, right? Not understanding how susceptible life science venture capital is specifically to interest rates, given the very long stretches of having no revenue and burning massive amounts of money before becoming supremely profitable. Life science companies are much more susceptible to interest rate fluctuations if you're looking at the net present value of future cash flows compared to a lot of other sectors of venture-backed companies. So I don't know. I hope that they are sort of sitting there doing a after-action review. Hey, how did this happen? How do we make sure we don't do this again? And then lastly, what can developers of other asset classes learn from this colossal capital destruction event that these life science REITs have engaged in, speculatively building so much product that the market just simply does not need right now?
Okay, well, so let me suggest what may be different now is the possibility that these folks, the original principals, have been able to get their money out via recapitalization. If I'm not mistaken, that RAD project has been recapitalized twice. So in this notion that builder's going to build, developer's going to develop, And it isn't, the failure of the project will not necessarily wash out the original principals. Like maybe they've had an opportunity to get their money out. And so, you know, somebody just came in with a mezzanine debt, right? At that RAD project. I don't know who it was that the Bank of the Ozarks gentleman was referring to it as stronger than the original principles. So somebody's coming in with money, but the idea that the, you know, was it reckless? Maybe. Was it irrational? Maybe not. If these folks have been able to get into it and sell the dream downstream and get their money out, maybe it's the follow-on money. I don't know. Bank of the Ozarks, maybe they'll have some explaining to do if this project goes back. But just to the point that the original folks, the one theory of the case is they've gotten their money out, which is crazy to think about.
Maybe. And that's, you know, they may have. Sometimes these follow-on lenders are doing it very strategically, like this mezzanine debt. I've seen a number of examples over the years of lenders coming in and providing tranches of mezzanine debt or other types of debt to be able to ultimately get control of the asset. You got to be in the stack to, you know, to have the opportunity to foreclose, the opportunity to renegotiate with other lenders. So there's very smart people circling these distressed projects to try to get control of them through the debt stack rather than from the equity partners, right? And you can, we'll see it play out, but there's a bigger play probably going on. If we know sitting in the, you know, the brokerage community that these assets are troubled from a financial perspective, the big, you know, all of the distressed funds are circling, I'm sure. So we'll see how that plays out. But I think, Tucker, to your point earlier on where some of the issues were, I think people also on the, you know, on the user side are starting to look at, and this is where I think, you know, it's like back to being optimistic. The companies that were venture funded that had these great ideas and had potential, you know, drugs or drug discovery ideas that could change the world. They were very reactive and they were somewhat forced into real estate decisions based on very limited options. A lot of them tried to do their own lab work and their clinical work within their own space. So they would be forced to take, if they needed, you know, a couple hoods and a small amount of infrastructure, 2, 3, 10 times that, who knows, because that was all that was available, right? They needed 5,000 feet with a couple hoods and they ended up in 10 or 20,000 feet because that's what they were forced to take. What we're seeing now in the marketplace, and this is, I think, you know, things start to evolve and people get smarter, about these cycles, is companies just taking office space and outsourcing the clinical work, right? Or using shared spaces to do the clinical work, where before they would take 10 or 20,000 feet, have their own lab space within their footprint and burn cash very quickly. Now they're going and taking 5 to 10,000 feet of office space, probably not 10, 5,000 feet of office space. And as their clinical work comes, they're outsourcing it to, you know, to others to do it. Huge savings in the amount of burn. Their burn rates reduce drastically when you're not taking super expensive lab space. So I think that's, you know, it's part of the problem with absorption right now because companies aren't absorbing the space that was built. But it should help kind of the next generation of companies as they're formed think about the real estate decisions that they're making differently and hopefully allow them longer runways and allow them to focus their investments or the investments of their teams more towards the science rather than the real estate to support the operation.
Good stuff. I've got one last thing and then why don't we wrap this thing up. In the discussion today, there's been a lot about labor. We talked about labor with you know, the data centers early on, obviously labor impacts demand. But interesting, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. I just wanted to raise this about a grocery store. Now, think about groceries. I mean, such a commodity business, if you will. Like everyone has to eat. We all got to get groceries. You know, we've all tried, I'm sure, everything from going to Costco to Whole Foods. to your local store, to, you know, buying stuff on Instacart, etc. But there's this discount grocery retailer in Brooklyn, New York, called Save-A-Lot. And they partnered with a company called Fabric, who is using robots to transform the grocery shopping experience. And what they do is they operate in a small warehouse, employing no more than about 10 people per shift. And these robots in this vertically integrated warehouse can grab your groceries in 6 to 8 minutes, have them ready for an Uber driver to pick up and deliver to your house if you live within 8 miles, all within 30 minutes. So it's fast. I mean, and what's interesting about this is that the company, Fabric, who's developed this technology, is suggesting that it can reduce grocery prices by 30%. So think about like a Trader Joe's, for example, who has been very reluctant to embrace online shopping. In fact, they don't do it at all. You have your brick and mortar retail store. You've got always constrained parking. I've never been to a Trader Joe's where I've showed up and like found a parking spot. It's always a nightmare. And you know, you've got to employ all the people that are working within the warehouse, a lot of them, which are unionized, and there's nothing wrong with unions, but they're getting paid a lot, to something like this, where, you know, from your phone, you just grab the essentials. Maybe it's not your weekly big trip if you got a big family to feed, but it's the stuff that you need that evening, all delivered to your house in 30 minutes. And maybe you live 10 miles away, so it takes an hour. But at a 30% discount and never having to leave your house. I mean, that's pretty compelling. And I think the article suggests it's part of a larger movement right now where grocery retailers, you know, in a very low margin business, a razor thin margin, I think the margin on groceries is like single digits, low single digits. Companies like Walmart are doing the same thing. They're trying to find ways in which to use robots to modernize warehouses, to, you know, enhance the shopping experience and save you money. Pretty interesting. And we'll see if this picks up, but I love people that disrupt the industry, especially industries that have been around since the beginning of time. And before you comment on that, I just got to bring one thing back to Elon. Boeing this weekend announced that they're laying off 10% of its workforce. Okay. 17,000 jobs. Not to mention, I read that they have 30,000 machinists on strike right now since September. And they're burning through $1 billion in cash because of the ongoing strike. I mean, crazy amounts of money. Now, I was like thinking while you guys were talking about SpaceX, and like, gosh, you never hear about this stuff at SpaceX. But the real big reason I think that they're so more nimble and so much more able to produce at such higher speeds, Boeing is ridiculously reliant on third-party suppliers. Think of all the suppliers that provide parts to our Boeing aircraft. I live in Seattle, as you guys know. We have lots of companies, north and south of the city, that are only there because they are providing parts to Boeing. Whereas SpaceX is, like, as far as I know, extremely vertically integrated, and they handle almost all the production in-house, which gives them probably greater control on costs, I imagine, and schedules and labor. And they obviously rely a lot more on automation. So just, I wanted to bring that back. I was thinking when you guys were talking about SpaceX and what Boeing's going through, it's like, wow, talk about polarizing, two different polarizing companies that, you know, are doing things totally different than one another and having different success.
The challenge with unions is not so much necessarily the, you know, cost or workers' rights. Obviously, these strikes are, you know, very challenging and problematic for these companies. But unions also create some operational friction for companies, right? Where, you know, you'll have someone that says, hey, can you pass me that tool over there? And they legally cannot pass the tool because it prohibits their union requirements and it's taking someone else's job. So it's not just the, you know, cost. You know, union tax, if you will, of everyone getting paid more. It's also the operational inefficiencies to protect other people's jobs in the union that can be really challenging for these companies to navigate. And then related to the supply chain piece that you're talking about, Owen, one of the, like kind of magic components of what SpaceX and a lot of the next generation hardware technology companies are doing is instead of going out and hiring a supplier to build some really customized, exquisite part, they're actually attempting wherever possible to tap into more commercial supply chain markets where they're not dependent on a single supplier that can only produce at a certain capacity. And that allows you to be way more nimble in scaling up and scaling down production since you have less customized parts. And what SpaceX has done is the customized parts that are required, a lot of that has been vertically integrated, but wherever possible, these companies are generally tapping into these commercial supply chains that are just producing an order of magnitude higher quantities than these very specific defense and aerospace specific supply chains are producing. But anyways, I'm sure many others have comments on this. We have no more time. We must wrap. We're already at an hour and 10 minutes here. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Definitely a lot of glimpses into the future in this episode. We'll be back with more real estate and glimpses into the future in our next episode in a couple of weeks. Thank you.